do we ever love that LA marathon. It took me an hour to get here. So we're starting a little late today with bad speakers in the background. Maybe I'll just monitor on headphones. We've changed the name. Now it's let's turn this down. Mind Control, which is what you will get today as we speak with Rob Sterling, if I can get him on the phone here. So let's listen to some Guido Monks and maybe some mix. Radio Matador, brought to you by the Independent Media Center and Regeneration TV.
Finally, Robert Sterling of the Conformist e-zine, the foremost authority and source for the news behind the news, the parapolitical view. Welcome, Rob.
How you doing?
Let's see, you are currently not living in Los Angeles, although it doesn't matter since the Conformist goes out on the internet at www.conformistwithak.com. I've known you for quite a while, at least a few years here. And oh, hey! And we're joined in studio with by another one of the stalwarts of the conspiracy community, John Vankin, and his wife, Debbie. How are you? I don't know if I can mic you. The other mic is this one.
I'm sorry, Deb.
John and Deb are here.
How did that happen?
I don't know. They walked in. The door was open. I think this microphone
will...
Yeah.
I think it's working now.
Great, we can get us all on at the same time.
Well, this is a big surprise.
Yeah, huge surprise. So, actually, a lot of parapolitical history for most people starts with the Kennedy assassination, which is why I played that thing just now, and continues from there. Rob, maybe you could trace for us your kind of like secret history of the 20th century, maybe from... like the Kennedy assassination on, unless you care to take it back a little bit further than that.
Well, yeah, I mean, if anything, the importance of the Kennedy assassination isn't so much for the event itself as how society reacted to it. I'm actually of the opinion, and this probably would put me in the deeper conspiracy theorizing view, which I, of course, think is more accurate in this case, where that the Kennedy assassination isn't so much the change in the power structure as in the change in society's realization of the power structure. It's actually kind of more the point of Noam Chomsky, and I'm trying to think of some of the other dissidents, although I don't disagree with them. I disagree with them that when they claim that the JFK assassination wasn't a conspiracy, but I do agree with them that, for the most part, it didn't change things that much. Maybe I'm, like, totally going way advanced for your listeners right now. Maybe I should...
No, I'm not going to underestimate the intelligence of any of the listeners, or even their background. We can talk about whatever we want.
Right, but it's kind of good to, you know, there's a good chance that some of your viewers are listening to this and saying, what the hell is he talking about? Although, you know what, you should be flattered to have so many viewers where you have enough asking that question. Having said that, I think the real fundamental issue behind the Kennedy assassination, to me, is the realization that it caused in the public where they saw something and they saw official response to it. And slowly there was cracks in the official story that people began to disbelieve. And, you know, that's really what the whole 60s decade was about, the destruction and deterioration of the belief of authoritarian values. And I think that the Kennedy assassination is a perfect example of that. Can you hold on 1 second? Maybe you can get Vankin on there.
Yes, John's here.
Okay,
maybe I can ask John the same thing. John Vankin, author of Conspiracies, Cover-Ups, and Crimes, is here in studio with us. And if it doesn't feed back too much, we can talk to him about this a little bit. Same kind of question for John right at this moment while I go turn on the fan because I'm burning up.
What was the question?
History of, I suppose you could call it parapolitical thought or commentary or conspiracy, has been in this country and what broke that open. If you think it's the Kennedy assassination or starting back with somebody like George Seldes, who used to do the same thing back in the 30s.
Well, I think in terms of the popular mind, it definitely was the Kennedy assassination. Because even though there'd always been, and there always have been, always will be, people who are interested in conspiracy and parapolitics and that sort of thing, I think it really took a catastrophic event to heighten people's perceptions of that sort of alternate political reality. So yeah, I think it did start there, but I think that the Vietnam War, the Watergate, the economic recession, recession, I guess, almost a depression, the 70s, runaway inflation in the 70s, I think it just led to sort of a general disillusionment and more willingness, I think, especially in the 70s, more willingness on the part of the public to, you know, to see politics and to see history in a way that they had not necessarily been taught in high school and college.
Uh-huh. I had noticed in the last few years, at least since a lot more cable stations have come up and all that, commercials, all this, these conglomerates and corporate interests and advertising, all this, they're kind of reaching into that culture and kind of codifying suspicion of the government or nonconformity as something to be commercialized and commodified.
Well, that's always been the way, though. I mean, even in the 60s, do you think, like, the counterculture barely existed long enough to establish itself before it started to be turned into Volkswagen commercials?
Right.
You know? So, and I think, and punk, the same thing in the 70s. You know, how long was it before punk became new wave and you started seeing those images on TV
commercials? Two or three years,
and movies. Yeah, a couple of years.
Now it's months, maybe.
Yeah, now it's months or even less.
Right.
Because, you know, our culture has been so accelerated by cable and the internet and so on and so forth. But I think that you look even tonight, there's the premiere of The Lone Gunman.
Yeah, I was just about to mention that.
You know, I mean, pop culture is completely subsumed, I think, this counterculture of parapolitical thought, if you want to call it that, and on the one hand, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because I think it's always good to sort of introduce those little thought viruses into the mainstream. In fact, that was the whole reason I even wrote the books that I wrote. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. On the other hand, I think to stay vital and important, that, you know, that strain of thought that's outside of the mainstream has to find a way to keep itself from being completely just sucked up in the vacuum.
Rob's part of that, especially through the internet. How do you think, Rob? Do you really reach a audience? Thank you, John. Do you really reach an audience besides somebody who might be interested in the subject matter in the first place, like somebody who's a conspiracy theorist? I mean, do you have links with more mainstream sites, or does the X-Files give you any? Does their site or you know, Art Bell, for that matter, give you any kind of support or linkage or anything like that? How do you get your message out past people like us?
Well, you know, I really do believe in no small part, and allow me to toot my horn, that...
Toot away.
I think that the effects of, you know, in particular the conformists, but, you know, stuff on the Internet in general, far exceeds even what I may believe it is. I remember, you know, and it's funny talking about this right now, because now it's well known, but almost 3 years ago, or over 3 years ago, I began writing about this bizarre, weird subject that nobody really knew anything about, called genetically engineered foods. And it literally, no one was writing about it. And now it's, you know, one of the greatest consumer public concerns going. And I think when you look at something like that, I do know that I was in no small part part of a movement of making this part of mass awareness.
It's funny you bring that up, because I wanted to bring things into present day news and see, you know, to show people how relevant things are continuously, how the power structure tries to keep certain amounts of information from us. And I wanted to know, either of you, John or Rob, what was your take on the recent mad cow disease outbreak again in Britain, and now there's a foot and mouth. Exactly. You know, my first thing after hanging around with wackos like you two was biowarfare experiment gone awry. And there are a couple people that are reporting on that, like Ted Oliphant and Peter Jordan, I think, out of New Jersey, still do that. But do you have any kind of backstory on something like that, either of you, this current subject?
I actually do, surprise, surprise. and I just found out about it yesterday, because I was talking to some people from England, or Britain, or whatever you want to call it, UK. One of those places where they have rotten teeth. Anyways, they were telling me that the cows, you know, they're slaughtering the cows in whole in these areas. And even though there's insurance on these cows, what they're going to get per cow is a minimal amount as compared to what the cows are actually worth. You know, it's basically, I think what it is they're getting the cost back rather than the actual, what they would get
market
in market
value.
If they cut up and sold the meat.
Right.
And, you know, unless if there's some sort of subsidy that's gone on with this operation, which very likely will not, or will not really cover it enough for many, there's going to be quite a lot of bankruptcies on farms in England, you know, and the UK. And you think about that, this is kind of what the whole thing with, I believe, ATM.
I was about to mention that, because the soy market.
Yeah, well, what they do is, you know, a lot of these farmers, in, for example, in the United States, they went bankrupt during the 70s and 80s, and it got into bigger and more corporate farming, who had a director-tied relationship to companies like ADM, and it basically...
Archer Daniels Midland.
Yeah, which creates more of a centralized form of agricultural, you know, economy. And you look at that, and, you know, I don't want to say, therefore, ADM kind of masterminded some sort of biological warfare plot to do this, but if they had, it would have worked, you know, it's working perfectly according to plan. You know, that's just food for thought, as some would say.
Yeah, it's probably why I changed the name of the show to Mind Control from Radio Mysterio, so I have no idea. Maybe I'll leave it. The thing I said about Ted Oliphant is that he had done some research about cattle mutilations and found out that, or also Peter Jordan, had found out that people, not only were these black helicopters hanging around, they were also landing in the middle of the night. There were helicopters with blades that were feathered so you couldn't hear them, so they were very quiet. And this kind of thing would, at least the cattle mutilation thing, would serve a lot of purposes if it wasn't, you know, quote-unquote aliens, like covert operations exercise, the spread of disinformation, you know, amongst the farmers in the community and all that, how you could control that. And even the most important thing, biowarfare testing, because a lot of things are found in the cattle's bodies, which aren't normally in there, like anticoagulating agents, and some of the cows were put under infrared or, no, ultraviolet light, and the ones that were mutilated had marks on them, like they had been marked by somebody from the air dropped onto them. So things are not what they seem a lot of the time, especially when you start getting into these weird areas and there's like this laughter curtain thrown up so that maybe something questionable, you know, like performing biowarfare experiments within the borders of the United States could be covered up under the rubric of, oh, well, it's just people talking about silly aliens and the cows were just killed by, you know, wolves or predators or through, you know, just rotting away with bacteria and stuff like that, where if you look into it, as in a lot of these subjects, if you look into it a little deeper, there's a backstory there which has some merit to it, and enough that if it was ported on the regular news, like if Dan Rather came on and talked about it, people wouldn't be going, that sounds like a conspiracy theory. now I'm going on. It's not even my show. Another thing recently that Rob sent out a lot of information on has been the power deregulation and then the power crisis in California. I have not kept up on that whatsoever, so I was wondering if either of you had some kind of parapolitical story on that aspect of what's going on in this nation, and actually will probably spread to other states pretty soon. At least that's what's reported, and Bush is doing nothing about it. I'll let you guys talk about that. Go ahead, Rob. John is waving at the speakers now.
Who's waving at the speakers?
John.
Oh, okay. He wants no moss of that. Okay. well, you know, this is one of those cases, again, where you really can't call it a conspiracy theory so much because I don't think it's necessarily in secret what's going on. There was a deregulation plan that was put through... It was basically Pete Wilson's plan, but it was, you know, not to absolve the Democrats of it. It was passed unanimously by both houses of California houses. And basically what it did is it changed the electricity market. What they did, though, is they still had... people couldn't buy the electricity centrally themselves. Companies like PG&E,
California Edison, Electric. Yeah.
What they did is they were allowed to sell their, and they were kind of encouraged to sell their electricity output themselves, their electricity plants, and they sold the vast majority of them to. Electricity companies out of state, most notably located in Houston, Texas. And the supposed theory was by having multiple suppliers of electricity itself, it would create competition and prices. The reality, however, is that by not having the ability to, you know, whatever price that could be sold for this electricity be capped, there's actually, like, you know, maybe, I don't want to say the exact number, but there's primarily about 7 or 8, electricity output companies out there, or energy companies. And when you have that few, in such an oligopoly, if they can, through illegal price fixing, I might add, scheme and, control the supply, they can maximize profits. And, like, for a megawatt hour, about a year ago, it was $35 per megawatt hour.
Mm-hmm.
For electricity. And this year, it was up to $1,400, you know, 40 times that amount.
What was the company in? I'm sorry. What was the company in Texas that the Bush family had the ties to? That was selling the oil that would power the power plants.
Well, there's a
Enron,
lot of them,
yeah.
But the
Johnson
most
Enron.
Notable one, and the one that you're thinking of, is the Enron Corporation.
Right.
Kenneth Lay is the CEO, and he was one of the biggest supporters of the George W. Bush political career. That not only his governor's races, but also the presidency. And he was, in fact, floated as the potential energy secretary for the alleged president, George W. Bush.
Actually, we can talk about this alleged presidency a little bit later.
Yeah.
Also, maybe a little bit more about the Bush family, since that's a sexy subject right now. And
that's always a sexy subject.
Oh, of course. I mean, John pointed out in his book, if there's any nexus of, you know, last 30 or 40 years of conspiracy, I guess, your parapolitical thought and discussion, it's the Bush family, and specifically George Bush. I'm going to play a little music right now so we can take a breather, and then we'll come back and talk about George Bush, George Shrub Bush, and the Nazis, and other connections like that. This is Mind Control on killradio.org, brought to you by Regeneration TV and the Independent Media Center. We'll be right back with Rob Sterling and John Vankin.
It was a nice, clean assassination. The gunman slipped through immigration like the gentle wind that swept the plain and ruffled over waves of grain. Sailing safely out of sight on board the next connecting flight, the gunman smiled, he felt no pain. So
yesterday.
Hey, Rob, just a sec.
Oh, sure.
The RAA sent out letters to like 50 different ISPs telling them that they can't, or trying to stop them from allowing their users to access OpenNAP, which is the open source version of Napster. So it's like the crackdown on the alternative Napsters has begun already.
Yeah, and I just saw a headline in the LA Times, which I didn't read the rest of it because I was looking through the newspaper dispenser thing, but the toilet paper dispenser said that they're trying to immediately block like 1 million files right now that are supposedly copyrighted. I was thinking everything on Napster practically is copyrighted, probably 95% of it, even stuff people that normally would never listen to. You know, I'm downloading Aleister Crowley stuff once in a while. I mean, somebody's got to have a copyright on that. Who gets the money?
I mean, under most current copyright laws, basically anything that is created is copyrighted. I mean, any piece of music or writing or anything like that is copyrighted. So, I mean, everything on Napster is copyrighted, I think, pretty much by definition, unless the artist specifically says that this is available for public use.
Right. As a few of them have.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's going to be an interesting thing to see if there can be a last-minute deal cut, because, like I said, sooner or later... it seems to me it is in the interest of the recording industry, and I don't see why they don't get it, to have a centralized mechanism that they can get money from, like Napster. And it's actually good for customers, too, because the one good thing about Napster is because it has such a huge market, you can get so much stuff. So, you know, paying them like $5 a month, which is what the plan that Napster was and may still be trying to develop, is even good for customers, because you know with that many customers that they have on it, you can find just about anything.
Yeah, and you know that the recording industry is not going to go for that because it's good for the most amount of people.
Well, but it's actually even good for them because, first of all...
Yeah, but they didn't come up with it, which would mean their dicks are slightly smaller.
You know what? You've hit on a nail, I think, with the real problem that Napster has, the recording industry has with Napster. It isn't that... it isn't their plan. It's the plan that they didn't come up with. You know, it's just like... with banks and actually in the West LA area of Santa Monica, where the city of Santa Monica passed an ordinance that required that ATMs in the city of Santa Monica had to not charge an extra fee for people using their ATMs that aren't their banks. And the truth is that these banks still would get a cut of any transaction. So it wasn't like they were losing any money off of this. So that, you know, that's one of the myths about it, because even though the bank couldn't add a surcharge, they still got a percentage fee from the original bank itself.
Right, right. You get double dipped by the banks.
Yeah.
The
ATM. So the issue wasn't about profitability, because what the banks then did in retaliation is they pulled ATMs and closed them in the city of Santa Monica. And the issue was not about profits, why they did it, because they still were making money. The issue was about control, and they did not want to have, not only in this city, but every other city, having cities have control over what fees they have. And I think it's the same thing with Napster, the RIAA, is that they're a big gun. They want to deal with fellow big guns. I think they're already trying to develop the RIAA is trying to develop some sort of scheme with Amazon where they could have some sort of big business partnership. And that's, I guess, what the real battle is.
Yeah, and Napster's backed by BMG now, which is, or they've bought them out, or they're supporting
their
partner,
sort of
which is the biggest music company in the world, I think.
And, you know, that was a smart
German
move, and frankly, I think it's good... I still feel that the recording industry is going to do something where they basically all align under Napster, but it'll have to be done in a way where they can look like they didn't give in any way, which they wouldn't really be anyways.
Yeah, well, at least publicly, which I suppose is all that counts.
Now, now it's basically about ego and control, and control is the... as you put it, is the deeper cynical reason. And ego is the, even if they can get over the control issues where they feel satisfied in control, they still must frame it in a way where they can proclaim their winners.
Right. Now that I'd mentioned BMG, which is a German company, we can get back to the Bush and Nazi connections. There's a strange link for you. Most people don't know about the history of the Bush family from before World War II up to when George W. Bush became vice president, CIA director, then vice president, and now his son with the debacle in Florida. You know what? There's a billboard right outside our studio that says, "What mandate? National election results," with Gore leading Bush by 500,000 votes, a little over 500,000. What do either of you have to say about the Florida recounts? There was one done by two or three different newspapers, four. One of them was a Republican, and then Republican-owned, whatever, no, Republican viewpoint, conservative newspaper, and they all agreed that Gore had actually won not only the popular, but the electoral vote there in retrospect.
But then the latest one that came out had Bush supposedly winning by a few votes, so... I mean, it's hard to know. I think that count, that was the count, the one that has Bush winning, that didn't count the overvotes, as they're called, the ones where people voted twice. They were only counting the undervotes, which is where there was, had the, you know, the fame, now famous Dimple Chads and all that stuff.
Right.
But if you add in the overvotes and try to discern which one, you know, who was actually voted for, I think Gore, you know, in those cases, Gore comes out ahead pretty big compared to what the margin is now. So.
Yeah, it's a complicated issue. Maybe Rob can get a little bit into the election fraud, and, well, John too, and the connection with Jeb Bush, who just happened to be the governor of Florida, and his brother.
Yeah,
ahead,
well, I wanted to add something to that Svankin could talk about more, because what I thought was really incredible on your site, conspire.com, for those out there with a C and not a K, is the fact that, you know, all this talk about Dimple Chads and things like these, which seem like some alien language that nobody had heard before. You were writing about this like over 10 years ago. Am I correct about
that? Yeah, I did a piece like 11 years ago that I for Metro, the newspaper in San Jose, and I put it on the conspire.com site. It's still there if anyone wants to go to the archives on conspire.com. Just go to www.conspire.com and click on archives, and you'll find it in there. Yeah, I mean, all these problems have been known, you know, and not secret at all. For a long, long time. I mean, and when I was writing about it, I was not the first person to write about it. I mean, these problems had been covered for years prior to that, even going back into the early 70s. So the problems with computerized voting, counting, vote counting systems, and that sort of thing. So it just so happened that here was a presidential election, you know, that was very close, and so the problems just came out into the open. But they occur in every single election. And I think most people don't realize how uncertain the results of almost any election in this country actually are. I mean, unless you're talking about a major landslide, any closely contested election is essentially uncertain and decided by technicalities and these sort of definitions of how ballots are to be counted and shuffled around. I remember back when I was doing that story, this was 1989, I guess, you know, I went into the rooms where people were counting votes and that sort of thing, and, you know, saw them anyway, and talked to voting registrars, and they just routinely talked about how when they couldn't tell, you know, when there was a hanging Chad, they would just pull it right off if it was hanging by two corners or something like that, and or in some cases where the ballot had been damaged or the votes were not discernible, the vote counters, who in most cases are volunteers, little old ladies basically, would actually fill out a whole new ballot. So they'd actually be voting for you. They just fill out a ballot, you know, trying to figure out how you probably voted, and that ballot would then be the one that's put through the machine to be counted. So, I mean, it's such an incredibly uncertain process that you know, it amazes me why we're so wedded to the idea of technological vote counting. I mean, there's really only one way to and you can never ensure security, but paper ballots and just counting by hand is really the most certain way to do it.
Well, you know what's really revealing about that is, you know, not too long, I think it was like less than a month later than our election, Canada had their own election, and they counted by hand all ballots. They didn't use computers, and they did it in something like 3 days, if that.
Yeah. And England, I think, the same thing in their recent election.
Yeah.
It was all it's all paper ballots, and it's all counted by hand, and they wrapped it up in a matter of days.
Well, and keep in mind, unlike the United States, people would say, well, yeah, Canada has a smaller population, but that actually works against Canada because, in essence, they have to count as many votes without as much population density.
Right, with less people counting. I mean, just by population. People are calling for internet or full computerized voting, which I immediately get suspicious of because you think there's a chance for fraud with computerized ballots. Just think if it's only a data stream.
It's an insane idea.
It's a completely insane idea, and another thing is what they call DREs, which are direct recording machines, or essentially ATMs for voting. And once again, I mean, I've talked to computer experts who,
I went and did that this year in Beverly Hills because I coun't be here on election day. I used one of those things.
Oh, they used
the
one
touch
of those?
Screen
the touchscreen
voting things.
Where there's, did it give you a receipt of what you had voted for?
It gave me a receipt that I had voted.
You had voted.
Not what I had voted for.
Because, yeah, and obviously you have no way of knowing whether what you touched on the screen was what was recorded on the computer chip, and then you have no way of knowing if what was recorded on the computer chip is what was sent out to the centralized vote counting.
See, I should never have voted for Nader, see?
Your vote for Nader, I'm sure, didn't count.
Exactly.
So, and it's also just companies that sell these things trying to make money. I mean, it's a fairly big business, and you got to keep, as in any type of computer or electronics business, you got to keep coming up with new products and keep selling new things to stay in business. You can't, you know, that's why Apple's not selling, you know, the Apple IIc in the year 2001. And so you got to keep coming up with new stuff. So,
and convincing people that they actually need it, which is probably half the budget of R&D is just the propaganda.
It's really a shame because, I mean, I've talked to...
Do I need this? No, probably not.
Yeah, I talked to one expert who said she teaches computers, and she could teach a 12-year-old to write a program that would defeat these DRE machines and their supposed security things. It's be so easy. And if a 12-year-old can do it, then who knows what someone who had more nefarious purposes could do. Or just plain old error. And that's what, you know, one, I don't know, maybe it was a combination of both that happened in this recent election. Who knows? But, you know, it's every single election. I mean, you've got to have a paper trail. You've got to have a record of how people voted for the election to be worth anything.
Yeah. And it might not even have mattered in Florida, according to what I was trying to get Rob to talk about. With the political aspect of it, where it kind of was a banana republic vote, and just about any other country, people would be in the streets shooting guns and, you know, taking down barricades, etc.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Clinton, after the election, he was quoted as saying basically that in any other country, people wouldn't be in the streets over this, and I'm glad that in our country we have enough faith in the system to not do that. And I remember reading that and thinking, you know, boy, you know, is he really complimenting us or is he, like, laughing at us for being the biggest group of suckers on the planet? Because literally we should have been in the streets over this. And, you know, I'm still, of course, circling the deeper issue that you're talking about. But before we start talking about the demon seed shrub Bush and his family of evil spawn, let's also point the fingers elsewhere. I mean, one of the real reasons this swindle happened was because of Al Gore. And I'm not just merely talking about how he blew his campaign. I'm talking about the fact that after the election happened and there was, you know, obviously this huge controversy, while the Republican Party was basically paying people and flying them out to Florida to be, you know, AstroTurf protesters. You had you actually had labor unions and African American leaders who were planning to stage these huge demonstrations, and they were all begged by Al Gore and the Democratic Party not to. They were begging their own people, their own supporters, not to go to the streets over this. And I think that's perhaps the real reason why Al Gore lost, is that Al Gore and the Democratic Party were ready to throw in the towel from moment one. And I think what it came down to, why they were so eager to cover up this outrage among, you know, labor unions and African Americans in particular, two groups that, you know, would have had the organization skills to do something about this, was that I think the Democratic Party wants to pretend that it's got a higher income group. You know, they want to appeal to the BMW crowd, and they're embarrassed by the fact that that even with all their attempts to mimic the right-wing reactionary policies of the Republicans, they're still, their meat and potatoes is the working class, the poor class, and minorities.
Well, why would they, here's a good question, why would they try to appeal to a group of people who are most assuredly less of the voting population?
You mean the BMW crowd?
Yeah.
Because the BMW crowd has more money.
Which equates to more money for elections and...
Right. And I think that's what it's really about.
Right.
And, you know, you aren't going to get a... You aren't going to become a servant of deep pockets by promoting the interests of the poor. That's for certain. Even labor unions, for all their supposed political clout, and they have enough an organizational structure, but they're nothing compared to big business. So whenever you hear talk about special interests, which is one of those fabulous code words that you hear about, special interests doesn't mean, whenever they talk about it in the public, you know, like the Rush Limbaugh, they aren't referring to you know, defense contractors. They aren't talking about huge corporations. No, when they say special interests, they mean groups like labor unions and African American or you know, other minority groups or gay lesbian groups. Groups that basically
have no power anyway.
Yeah, it's really just a what would be the term for that? You know, just basically a
whitewash.
A fake boogeyman.
Right, right, right. Which the government, certain elements of it in the media are very good at creating.
Yeah.
It's the beauty of a free press. You know, you think it's free, and it's basically run from a money standpoint, not from an information standpoint. Because if it was run from an information standpoint, people have been so programmed to think that it wouldn't be very interesting.
Well, a free press has to be paid for by somebody.
Right, right.
And fortunately...
There's the conundrum.
Fortunately or unfortunately, ours is paid for. And you can see what the general results of that are. You could even see it on the inauguration day of the supposed president. And let me just clarify for your listening public... the correct spelling is, of course, president without a capital P and in quotation marks.
Right.
just so if you want to know how to address them, that's how you do it. You know, there was actually mass protest against the inauguration, and, you know, the press tried everything it could to ignore this in all the reporting.
Yeah, kind of like the Democratic convention protests out here in Los Angeles. John actually had some direct experience with that. Maybe you can talk about a little bit about what went on and what wasn't covered here in Los Angeles anyway.
Well, I mean, just when we were down there, when my wife Deb, who writes for the LA Weekly, and I were down at the Near the Staples Center, I mean, we, along with a lot of other people, were chased around by the cops and sort of herded. Remember, sitting around in an area where really nothing was going on. We were just trying to get a few interviews with people. And nothing was happening. And then suddenly the police just attacked. I mean, it was just this massive sort of horseback-mounted, foot-charging, you know, fist-in-the-air-waving crowd of cops who were acting like some sort of bunch of soccer hooligans. And they corralled us through this narrow corridor with the train tracks on one side, and I got shoved onto the tracks at one point, got back off, obviously. But yeah, and Deb got hit in the leg with a baton, and you know, which was a lot less than happened to a lot of people, that's for sure. And another friend of mine, who was another writer who was just not even writing, he was just down there just because he wanted to be down there, who ended up getting shot in the head with a rubber bullet, and then, you know, it knocked him out, and then when he came to, he tried to get back up. Some other kid came over to try to help him up, you know, help him to his feet. Cops came over, started beating that guy with batons, and, you know, my buddy, the writer, was trying, he had a column that he had to turn out, and he, like, couldn't write for the next 3 days. He was lying in bed with bruises and headaches and stuff like that. And just, why? What are they doing? You know, what exactly was going on here? But, you know, I remember we turned on the radio the next day, and the main thing we heard on the, you know, our great commercial station like KABC was, well, police faced their first test last night and, you know, managed to control the crowd. And it was just, come on. I mean, yeah, so someone needed to control the police is what was really going on. But, you know, that's not the way the media spun it. And I think we've gotten to a point in history where I think almost everyone kind of knows what's going on. I mean, there's been so much media consolidation. So few companies own so much. But I think now, unlike, say, maybe, you know, a couple decades ago when Ben Bagdikian was writing his first edition of The Media Monopoly, people didn't quite believe it in this idea that there was only going to be five or six companies that owned virtually every major media outlet. I think now people know that that's the case, and they really just don't care. And that's what's really upsetting, and that's what makes it good that, you know, there's these little outlets like Kill Radio here to, you know, in defense of America, at least these little free media outlets can function without being shut down by the police, at least not yet.
Right. Yeah, are they RAAA, who are actually, oh no, ASCAP, I think, is starting to figure out that they should request fees for, well, ASCAP, actually, I don't have any problem paying to, because that's the musicians' union, but they want internet radio stations to start paying fees. There are ASCAP fees, not to mention, you know, the record companies. I'm going to play a little bit more music just to wake everybody up, and maybe some Jellaby Offer, but maybe not. Depending on how much time we have left. We've got about 10 minutes here with Rob Sterling of The Conformist and John Vanken, author most recently of, well, the one everybody would know him for, I guess, listening would be Conspiracies, Cover-Ups, and Crimes, but your newest book was?
The 70 Greatest Conspiracies of All Time, yes. And The Big Book of the 70s.
Right. Big Book of the 70s just came out. All these are available on Amazon, and we'll be right back on Mind Control on killradio.org. Stay with us.
That sums it up in one big long I claim all these garbage dumps in the name of the garbage pickers.
America.
Garbage pickers of America. Oh, but it smells.
Oh, the famous Charles Manson band from the Lie album, or whatever different guys people put it out on, with Garbage Dump. Inspiration for one of the great Manson books, The Garbage People, although Rob, right now, through his new publishing concern, The Conformist Collective, is putting out another and probably one of the best books on Manson yet, if you'd want to talk about that a little bit, Rob.
Yeah, it's going to be called Shadow of Santa Susana. It's going to be written, or it has been written, by Adam Gorightly, actually a rather well-known underground author and writer for magazines, most notably The Excluded Middle, which is, of course, edited by your host here, Greg Bishop, and, of course, Ken Thomas's Steam Shovel Press. He's written for that. Basically, it's kind of like a collection of all the alternative investigations of the Manson story, and really, after 30-plus years of being able to look back, is able to examine things like Maury Terry's The Ultimate Evil, Ed Sanders' The Family, and combine all the alternative conspiracy theories and other viewpoints, and really give a fabulous overview of the history of investigations of what the Manson family was really about.
Was he ever able to find out if Charles Manson actually tried out for the Monkees?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think he actually found out for sure.
Oh, damn, because I've got an artist lined up for the next issue. I'm going to write with him, and he's going to do the art. If Charles Manson had actually made the cut and gotten into the Monkees, how history would have been different. Now somebody else is going to steal that idea and put it in their zine, but I don't care because ours will be best. How?
It's like a pitch for a movie. I think that's what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Someone's going to pitch that.
Pitch that as an independent film, as if you need to pitch independent films. I guess you do now. It's a whole category. Alternative, independent. How is this book available yet, Rob?
It's going to be. There's this new kind of lightning press, per order press publishing called iUniverse, iUniverse.com for those out there. And it's really, I think, going to change the economics of scale of publishing by allowing smaller publishers like myself to come in with little capital and present books. And since there isn't as much of a downside, will open up huge economic opportunities for people like myself. I think in many ways, iUniverse could be the equivalent to publishing and writing what Napster will be for music.
Right.
Of course, the difference is that iUniverse has big money kind of behind it, so, you won't have to worry about lawsuits or anything.
John has completed recently, I guess in the last few months, it's been out for a while, a book called The Big Book of the 70s, so maybe we can get him to describe what that is, who the publisher is, what kind of reaction he's got so far, what kind of nostalgic reactions.
Well, the reaction has all been pretty good. I think people, readers have all been interested to take a trip back down memory lane, down through the 70s, but basically Big Book of the 70s is a, I guess you'd call it a graphic nonfiction anthology or something. It's basically a big comic book, goes for $14.95, it's like a coffee table book sort of format, paperback, but it's 50 plus stories of events that shaped the 70s and that have shaped our world since the 70s, and hopefully in humorous format, I think, with with the different artists on each story, so anyone who's into comics would really like the book. A lot of very well-known artists on there, and I wrote the scripts for all the stories. So if you're at all interested in what happened back in the 70s, I think this would be the book for you, I think.
I read it, by the way, and loved it as usual.
Oh, thank you.
Now, one thing that was interesting to me is, and I'd like to just get your kind of response to this, I almost sensed kind of like a relief that you weren't talking and writing about conspiracies, and I've almost sensed a desire to kind of go beyond that in your writing. Am I kind of correct?
Yeah, I think you're correct, though I should say, and this is probably a really premature announcement, but the current publisher of the 70 Greatest Conspiracies of All Time has contacted my co-author, John Whalen, and myself about doing yet another edition of the book. this one would be not the 80, but the 100 greatest conspiracies of all time. So, which in effect is, will be an entirely new book. So, so even though, yeah, I think your perception is basically correct. I mean, it's like I definitely would like to. Well, I have branched out. I certainly, probably what I'm best known for is the conspiracy stuff, but it's far from the only thing that I do. I'm probably going to be going back into it sometime later this year to do this 100 Greatest Conspiracies thing, which will be basically a completely new book with sort of revised and edited versions of the 70 chapters that already exist, plus 30 completely new chapters. And it'll probably come out in hardcover and be priced at something that no one can afford. So.
Don't you think it would have been smarter if they milked this whole thing so like they do like 71 greatest and 72 and work their way up to 100?
That's what I suggested, but now you thought, you know, just go for the big money right away and price it out in a pricey hardcover and get a whole bunch of overseas sales. But I think, you know, I mean, it's still way in the preliminary stages, and for all I know, it may never happen because a lot depends on... how willing they are to negotiate with us over our financial terms to produce the book, but I think if we do it, it'll be really something. It'll be very up to date. It'll be absolutely definitive with 100 chapters in there, and it'll be, you know, like a gift book, or like, you know, it'll be priced probably around $38.
Wow.
So, you know, with all the money that you make from this publishing venture, you'll probably be able to afford to buy one, actually.
That's the theory, anyway.
It should be the theory. I'll plug my own book at some other point.
Book? No, I want to hear about your book. I thought you were going to have a copy down here.
Oh, no, well, you know what? I dumped the copy off and because it was too heavy in my bag when I was bringing it here.
It's huge.
It's a long book. It's 430 pages. It's called Wake Up Down There, which the girl that did the layout said sounded like an ad for Viagra. It made me think twice about the title. But it's just a collection of everything out of my magazine. Well, the magazine started with two other people a few years ago, and then they dropped out, called The Excluded Middle. It's UFOs, psychedelics, parapolitics, 40 and stuff, like Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, Chupacabra, the goat sucker, and kind of spiritual issues, parapsychology, stuff like that, and how all these things intersect, because they do. And if you read the book, you'll find that out. I just went to Borders the other day and saw it there in the linguistics section. I don't know why.
Linguistics section? No.
So I took it out of there, and I put it on the top shelf in the paranormal section and moved, you know, Stan Friedman books down with.
I've seen the conspiracies, greatest conspiracies, filed under almost everything. I've seen it under humor. I've seen it under...
Humor.
I've seen it under current events. I've seen it under politics, seen it under history, sociology. Almost anything you can name. It's been categorized. Pop culture... weird, strange, I mean, yeah. No one quite knows where to put any of this material yet. I think that's part of the problems in getting it out to the general public. You can't get a Chris Carter or someone to make a TV show out of it.
Right, exactly. Well, I don't know, maybe they'll make a TV show out of the Excluded Middle, I have no idea. Or for that matter, out of Big Book of the 70s. But I guess they already have, a couple of times over now.
Before I even wrote it, actually.
The next DJ is not here yet, so we'll continue talking for a little bit. Maybe I'll play some music right now and see if she arrives, Lisa, for her show. Other than that, if she does come in, thank you for listening. Our guests have been Rob Sterling of the Conformist website, and now more recently the Conformist Collective, publishing empire, and John Vanken, author of 70 Greatest Conspiracies, 50 Greatest Conspiracies of All Time. Conspiracies, Cover-Ups, and Crimes in the Big Book of the 70s, and all over the internet. You just wrote a really funny article on the XFL, which I enjoyed thoroughly.
Wow.
The horrible, horrible XFL football league. This is Mind Control, and it's killradio.org, brought to you by Regeneration TV and the Independent Media Center. Thanks for listening, and maybe we'll be back in a couple minutes, and maybe we won't.
Seven, four, three, one, two, six, eight, seven, eight, one, six, two, three, five, four. 6, 2, 3, 5, 4, 7, 4, 3, 1, 2, 7, 4, 3, 1, 2, 9, 1, 5, 7, 5, 9, 1, 5, 7, 7, 1, 1, 2, 7, 7, 1, 1, 2, 5, 8, 2, 5, 8, 3, 0, 3, 0.
Right. 1, 6, 9. 1, 6, 9. 1, 6, 9. 1, 6, 9. 1, 6, 9.